From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Trump is meeting with Belgium's prime minister in Brussels after a private audience with Pope Francis in Vatican City earlier today on this Trump's first trip abroad since taking office. The Pope and the president have exchanged critical words in the past, but Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said the meeting today was positive, and Tillerson relayed an exchange on climate change.
We had a good exchange on the difficulty of balancing responses to climate change and ensuring that you still have a thriving economy and you can still offer people a job so they can feed their families and have a prosperous economy. And so I think we had a good exchange there, and we look forward to having further talks with them on climate policy.
When President Trump and his family left the Pope, he was overheard saying to the Pope, "Thank you. I will not forget what you told me." NPR's Sylvia Pagioli has been following the trip. Sylvia, do we know what the Pope said that President Trump will not forget?
No, we don't. It was a closed-door meeting, 30 minutes, just with their one interpreter, and we may never know exactly what they said. But there was definitely a very different mood, at least on the Pope's part, from the beginning. He was very dour at the start, didn't smile. President Trump was beaming. But at the end of the meeting, when the rest of the presidential entourage was brought in and he was introduced to the First Lady, Pope Francis began really smiling a lot. He seemed much more relaxed.
Well, we want to mention their exchange in a moment, but remind us of the tension between the president and the Pope, especially in the discussion of then-candidate Trump's pledge to build a wall with Mexico.
Well, it was after the Pope Francis visited Mexico in early 2016. He was asked by reporters, what did he think about candidate Trump's wall proposal? And Francis, who's an advocate for refugees and migrants, he said, building walls instead of bridges is not Christian. This is not the gospel.
Well, and here's how then candidate Trump responded.
For a religious leader to question a person's faith is disgraceful. I'm proud to be a Christian. And as president, I will not allow Christianity to be consistently attacked and weakened, unlike what is happening now with our current president.
Okay, so, you know, getting in a dig at both President Obama and the Pope, accusing the Pope of criticizing him. He also said that the Mexicans were using the Pope as a pawn. This was not a warm and fuzzy feeling, one presumes, between the two men.
Well, you know, neither side, neither the Vatican nor the administration, had any interest in this meeting in any kind of public controversy. They wanted it to go smoothly. And in fact, it did. I mean, as I said, we don't know specifically what they spoke about, but it's not likely that sparks were flying. In fact, at the very end, Pope Francis asked, he urged President Trump to be a peacemaker when he gave him, as a gift, a medallion depicting an olive branch, the symbol of peace.
Well, talk more about the exchange of gifts, because they carry messages.
Absolutely. And before leaving Rome, President Trump tweeted, "I leave the Vatican more determined than ever to pursue peace in our world." It's possible, you know, that the more substantive conversation was not with the Pope, but afterwards between the president and the Vatican Secretary of State, Cardinal Pietro Parolin. That lasted 50 minutes and there was no interpreter. So it was probably very substantial. And it's likely that the Vatican probably raised Trump's threat to pull the U.S. out of the Paris Agreement on climate change. That's an issue that's very, very dear to this Pope. He wrote an encyclical about it. He gave it to Trump as a present. And I'm sure they're very worried about that. So we'll see if that will have had an effect on the president's policy.
The Pope very much in favor of the Paris Agreement.
Absolutely.
Well, can you talk briefly about an image that's come out of the meeting today that went viral? This was Ivanka and Melania Trump wearing veils. In Ivanka's case, Melania wore a mantilla, head covering, very severe black dresses. People are questioning why they did that, but that has been custom, hasn't it?
Absolutely. It's total custom. It was remarked that they didn't cover their heads in Saudi Arabia, but in visiting non-Muslim women do not cover their heads in Saudi Arabia. It is a custom, the norm for women to cover their head, either with hats or lace veils that are often referred to with the Spanish word mantillas. That's a tradition here at the Vatican.
Well, but we did a deep dive on this, Wikipedia, and it looks as if at one time it was required. But then in the 90s, then President of Ireland, Mary Robinson, did not wear black or cover her head. In fact, she wore jewelry, and there was a huge upset over it. But the Vatican said, well, no, it's not obligatory. It's custom, but not required. But to what they didn't wear in Saudi Arabia, neither woman wore a head covering, neither did Michelle Obama.
Exactly.
Yeah. By the way, you mentioned a quick exchange between the Pope and the First Lady at the end. I guess he asked her what she feeds the president.
Yeah, there's some controversy there, what exact word he used. Some people thought pizza, and then it turns out that it was a Slovenian word for a Slovenian sweet called potica. But it's not clear whether the First Lady understood potica or pizza. So that is going to remain a mystery about this encounter.
Potica being a Slovenian festive strudel, we discovered. NPR's Silvia Pacioli, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, President Trump's budget director Mick Mulvaney testified on Capitol Hill today about the administration's proposed budget, which was released yesterday. It's called the New Foundation for American Greatness. But Mulvaney said they could have called it the Taxpayer First Budget.
This is a budget that was written from the perspective of the people who actually pay for the government. And we went line by line through what this government does and asked ourselves, can we justify this to the folks who are actually paying for it?
But Democrats saw things differently. Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal of Washington told Mulvaney that the budget cuts to food stamps and other programs are astonishing and immoral. And our next guest says the budget would reverse a number of the president's campaign promises. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us from New York. Hi, Derek.
Hi, Jeremy.
And let's first talk about what this budget means for some important programs. Back in 2015, then-candidate Trump tweeted that there will be no cuts to Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. What does this budget do to those three programs?
If the promise was threefold, no cuts to Medicare, no cuts to Social Security, no cuts to Medicaid, I think it's fair to say that this budget gets about 1.5 out of three. There are indeed no cuts to Medicare, but there are cuts to Social Security disability insurance, which is absolutely part of Social Security. It's right there in the name. And there are deep, deep, deep cuts to Medicaid, hundreds of billions of dollars worth, even above the AHCA, the Republicans' Obamacare repeal bill. This budget is coming from a White House, so it makes sense to call it the Trump budget. But in reality, it's really much closer to the traditional conservative wing of the GOP. It's really a OMB Director Mulvaney budget rather than a Trump budget. It seems to uphold way more promises from the Paul Ryan wing of the Republican Party than it upholds from the Donald Trump presidential campaign.
Well, it also would cut food stamp money by a third. Is that an idea that's going to have support among Republicans?
Republicans have a complicated relationship with food stamps. On the one hand, House Speaker Paul Ryan, the wonk-in-chief of the GOP, he has proposed food stamp cuts several times in past budgets, and Republican lawmakers have voted for those budgets, voted for those cuts. But Republican voters are another story. As the AP has reported, 7 of the 10 states with the highest food stamp participation rate voted for Donald Trump. So now that Republicans can't just pass symbolic budgets, they have to pass budgets that are actually going to go into law, are going to affect people. It will be very interesting to see what they do with food stamps. If they're willing to vote for a budget that's going to cut Medicaid by hundreds of billions of dollars, I have to believe that they'd be willing to cut food stamps by a bit. But the cuts in this bill, proposed budget from the White House, are rather draconian. So I'd be surprised to see all of them go through.
Where does this budget actually stick to the president's promises?
Yeah, there are places where the promises are mostly kept, mostly. He promised a bump in military spending. There is indeed a modest bump. He promised regulatory cuts, and indeed programs like the EPA are gutted. But again, I think the most important point to emphasize is how far this budget is from a perfect reflection of Trump's campaign promises. For example, very famously, Trump promised $1 trillion in infrastructure spending. The most recent infrastructure proposal is just about one-fifth of that. He promised full support for a wall most recently between the U.S. and Mexico after he reversed the idea that Mexico would pay for the whole thing. Experts say that wall would cost about $15 billion. He's proposed just one-tenth of that. So you add that on top of the cuts to Medicaid and Social Security disability insurance, and again, I think you do have a budget that is a much more accurate reflection of longstanding conservative Republican principles than it is a reflection of a Trump campaign that was, in fact, extremely heterodox, extremely unconventional, and willing to part with traditional Republican policy.
And your point being there that why would he propose a budget that doesn't fulfill all of his promises if the likelihood is that this proposal is nowhere near something that will get passed through Congress?
Right. I'm just extremely surprised that this budget seems designed to be unpopular. Trump is devoted now to his Obamacare replacement bill, which has an approval rating, I think, of that is two times worse than the Affordable Care Act. He's proposed now an historic tax cut at a time when 77% of Americans, 77% are opposed to cutting taxes on the wealthy. He's proposing this enormous cut to the welfare state, to Medicaid and food stamps and disability insurance at a time when a record number of respondents to a recent NBC Wall Street Journal poll say they want the federal government to do more to solve people's problems. Right. I think it was precisely Trump's ability to say, I don't have to marry myself to traditional Republican policy. I can say what I think the voters in front of me want to hear.
Right.
And suddenly a man who seems quite interested in being popular seems to be departing from those policies that would be most likely to ensure his popularity.
Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Thank you.
Thank you.
New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio wants to give every inmate leaving city jails a temporary job, a jails-to-jobs initiative scheduled to be in place by the end of 2017, a $10 million program that's part of a broader effort to reduce recidivism and cut back on the huge inmate population so the city can build smaller jails and replace the troubled Rikers Island. Inmates must have served a year or less. The jobs are for 8 weeks, hourly wages paid by taxpayers, the city, not employers. The hope is to get more employers on board and build a resume for ex-cons. Let's start with a supporter. Stanley Richards is executive vice president of the Fortune Society, a nonprofit that trains former inmates on how to land and keep jobs. He's also acting vice chair of the New York City Board of Correction, was once incarcerated. So, Stanley, you partner with the city now getting inmates jobs with nonprofit money. You hope to be part of the new program, the Jails to Jobs Initiative. Make the case for it.
So here's what we know, right? We spend $2.4 billion each year, New York City taxpayers, to create the machine called Rikers Island. What the mayor's proposing to do is to say, wait a minute, let's do smart investments. We know what doesn't work. We know mass incarceration doesn't work. We know isolation doesn't work. We know being punishing people for their entire life doesn't work. Let's try investing in people. And what we know at the Fortune Society is you invest in people, people build back, they build into their communities are safer. And we know it works. So the mayor's proposing a pretty bold plan that is consistent with the Lipman report that we came out with that says we need to close Rikers and reduce our footprint with regard to incarceration. And Jails to Job program was one program that'll do that.
The mayor is saying that $10 million a year is better than, as you said, the billions or $200,000 a year per prisoner for the cost of housing. But you know the arguments that there are people who haven't committed crimes who deserve jobs and that people who have been jailed should not be rewarded for that.
And this isn't about rewarding people for being incarcerated. This is about being smart, building healthier and safer communities, investing in how people come home. If someone who is looking for a job, who doesn't have an employment and needs employment, they could walk into any Workforce One center right now in New York City and get access to jobs and don't deal with the barriers people with criminal records deal with.
Look, as you mentioned, you were incarcerated. What were the issues for you coming out of jail? Would a job have helped? Did a job help?
Absolutely. I mean, I was cycling in and out of prison all my life, and I thought prison was the way my life was going to be. It wasn't until my last incarceration that I went to school, I got my GED, I went to college, I graduated college, and I started to begin to believe that my life could be different. If I only believed in myself, and I started to believe in myself, and I came home and I applied for jobs and I was rejected, and I knew as long as I never gave up on myself that things in my life could be different. And I was hired as a counselor at Fortune Society in 1991. And today I'm able to give back. I'm able to say to people, incarceration doesn't have to be your life choice. You have other options. There are people out here who are willing to support you to help you build back your life.
What about employers? I mean, it might be a hard sell.
You know, Fortune Society runs a transitional work program. We have great results. And part of what we do is we say, hey, put your stereotypes to the side and work with our people. Let them show you who they are in terms of how they show up. And you get to see they're good employees, you will make the investment. And so what we've seen and what this program will do is give an opportunity for employers, low risk to the employer, because only thing they're offering is an opportunity for them to work at their business. The financial piece of it will be paid for by the city. And what we hope and what we've seen at Fortune is that after the exposure, they end up hiring the individual.
Well, and employers, I'm sure, are being told as well that they're not just going to have an ex-con walk into their place of business. They're going to have inmates who will have peer navigators, right? Former inmates,
yes,
who have also done this successfully, so that there will be people guiding them.
Absolutely. What the mayor's proposing is to take a model that's been tested and to do it on a large scale.
What about Bernard Kerik's criticism? He has a unique point of view. He has it from both sides of this issue. He's, you know, the former New York City Police Commissioner and also the New York City Correction Department Commissioner. He also served time. We remember he served a prison term for tax fraud. So he's been in prison. And he says, look, this money should go to existing behind bars programs. Give high school educations and vocational training inside the prisons.
So here's the thing that really excites us about this mayor. That is actually happening. The mayor has, if you look at what Mayor de Blasio has invested, it's a significant investment. This is but one program. He has invested in hard skills training for people on Rikers Island. Now he's investing in transitional employment, the second phase of how you help people come home to be successful for themselves, for their families, and for the communities.
That's Stanley Richards, Executive Vice President of the nonprofit Fortune Society. Their funding comes from both the private sector and the government. He's also acting Vice Chair of the New York City Board of Correction, which oversees the city jails, which he once inhabited. He was incarcerated for robbery at Rikers and is now part of this new initiative. The city will be paying for employers to hire former inmates. Stanley, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, let's hear from a critic. Elias Husamuddin is president of the Correction Officers Benevolent Association, which represents 9,500 active workers at jails in New York City. Elias, 8-week jobs to ex-cons after they serve time paid for by taxpayers. Your thoughts?
Well, I mean, anything that's going to improve the quality of life in New York City, I'm a fan of. The problem that I have is, why is the mayor not proactive? The program they're discussing affects approximately about 1,300 inmates. And these people, some of them are doing 30 days, 60 days, 90 days. And the problem is, why not offer them this job training program before they go to jail? Most of them are unemployed. They don't have any type of certificates or degrees or diplomas. And to me, this is like saying, we know you're out there and you may be trying to do the right thing, but we prefer that you get in trouble, that you get arrested, and that you get sentenced before we offer you the type of assistance that we, as the mayor, should be offering.
Well, hold on there a second, because Stanley Richards, again with the Fortune Society, he says, you know, people can walk into Workforce One centers in New York City, get job training help. So you can get some help before you end up in jail.
Robin, I hear that. Mm-hmm. We have people, listen, there's no knock to the Fortune Society. They do a lot of work. But at the end of the day, I think they're being disingenuous, because there are a lot of inmates in our system who, before they got involved and got trapped in the system, were out there trying to get assistance. You think that someone who actually have this available to them, gonna say, you know what, I don't want that. Let me get locked up and then let me go and get what it was that I was trying to get before I got locked up. At the end of the day, if that was the case, we wouldn't have as many of these people.
You join the voices then who are calling for a slightly different reason. They're calling for people to have this $10 million jobs program who haven't gone to jail. You know, they're saying, why reward somebody who's been in jail? You're coming at it from a slightly different perspective. But you've also been quoted saying the mayor has apparently given up on keeping the jails safe for both inmates and correction officers who you represent. You cite the violence at Rikers Island. Now, the corrections department points to stats that show, you know, serious injuries have gone down. But you're right. There are huge questions about the safety of Rikers Island. That's part of the mayor's plan to ultimately shut it down. And part of that is not to have this huge population to keep people from coming back.
There is a safety issue in the jail system. And the reality is that even with talking about shutting down Rikers and shutting down the jails, I have one jail on Rikers Island that sits on 40 acres of land and holds 3,300 inmates. You would have to open three separate individual jails in the boroughs to cover that one jail. Mm. on Rikers Island. So that dream and thing of closing and shutting down Rikers and keeping the inmate population down below 5,000, I don't know. That's like some type of Jedi mind trick. I don't even know who came up with that. Let's just say allow the governor. The governor of New York is responsible for prisons. He's responsible for rehabilitation and offering programs and ensuring that these people, when they come back into the community, that they're better prepared than they were when they left.
But, just the notion of somebody promised a job, they get prepared for it in jail, but promised a job for 8 weeks. I mean, I'm sure you've heard of Greystone Bakeries, which is slightly upstate. They only hire people who've been in jail, give them housing. Doesn't that cut down recidivism?
Well, if you listen to certain people, it cuts down recidivism. And I'm not going to say that there are not those inmates who are positively affected by these type of programs, which is why I'm saying, listen, I live in New York. So it is within our interests to have these people, whether they're coming out of jails or whether they're coming out of prisons, to be a more productive citizen. So that's not something that we're fighting, but we're saying that we have a mayor who's putting more emphasis on these type of programs than he is on keeping the jails themselves safe. Our question is, what are you doing to keep them safe? Because they're not even going to be able to be involved in these programs because they're going to end up in the hospital, or they're going to end up with scars across their face and their heads and their arms because the jails are not safe. And that's our position.
That's Elias Husamuddin, president of COBA, the union representing 9,500 active workers at jail facilities in New York. Elias, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
The credit ratings agency Moody's is downgrading China's sovereign debt rating for the first time since 1989. The agency said in a statement it expects the country's financial health to erode somewhat over the coming years. But China's finance ministry posted a statement online saying that Moody's overestimated the difficulties in China's economy while underestimating the ability of the Chinese government to reform. Maggie Lake hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake. She joins us from New York. Hi, Maggie.
Hi, Jeremy.
So let's talk about what's happening in China. The economy there grew at nearly 7% in the first quarter of this year. What does Moody's see that's leading it to downgrade the credit rating?
Yeah, 7% sounds pretty good. Huh?
Right.
I think we'd like to be growing that fast. But, you know, China's economy is growing, but its debt is growing even faster. It's sort of like having a neighbor that looks like they're doing really well, new car, new clothes, and then suddenly find out it's because they're running up those credit cards like crazy. Now, it's not unheard of for countries to do this. You remember back in the financial crisis, there was that famous cartoon of Fed Chair Ben Bernanke dumping money out of the helicopter.
Right.
Helicopter Ben, he was nicknamed. Europeans and Japanese have also, you know, done it. They've lowered rates to stimulate borrowing. But for that to work, you need to be able to service that debt. Now, right now, to be clear, China can. Much of it's held by the government, though, and government banks lending to government-owned state companies. That makes people nervous. And there's also very little transparency. We don't really know how much debt's out there because a lot of this activity is taking place in what's called the shadow banking system. So you put it all together, and it's one of the big risks facing the Chinese economy.
But the other big rating agencies have not downgraded China, we should say. And according to J.P. Morgan, when you talk about the debt in China, they say China's total debt was 253% of its GDP last year, which is a big increase from the previous year.
Yeah, and that's what worries people. It's the speed. And China's trying to make this shift, right, from this, you know, export goods-driven economy to the service economy. They're trying to encourage people to spend. They're really trying to prop up that economy. But we learned really painfully back in 2007, 2008, how hard it is to pop a credit bubble. It's very painful. There's no easy way to do it. You see company failures, jobs lost, banks bailed out. And so people worry this is eventually what's going to happen in China. And a slowing China is going to hurt all of us. I mean, China, you're going to remember, is the big one of the big economic engines of this global economy. A lot of our companies, think about GM, General Electric, Apple, they would all feel the impact if China slowed down significantly because they had to really come to terms with this debt. People are hoping they get ahead of the problem, but that never seems to happen, Jeremy.
But we're talking about this today because of what Moody's did. And I wonder, given what happened in the run-up to the financial crisis with the biggest rating agencies continuing to give high ratings to the risky securities that ended up leading to a collapse, do they have credibility anymore?
I think their credibility is still an issue. They tend to move very slowly when it comes to assessing risk. And China got downgraded, but it is still investment grade. Now, to be fair, in the case of China, the rating agencies, along with banks and economists and experts I talk to, don't always have access to the most reliable data. We can't see the books of the state-owned companies. The government doesn't issue data the same way it does here in the West. So, you know, it's hard to make a call that's going to impact investment decisions when you don't have all the hard data. But I do think a lot of people think they could be more aggressive about sounding the alarm. We still have a lot of cases where the rating agencies move after everybody already arrived at the conclusion. And I think this is another one of those incidents. Nobody was surprised by this today.
That's Maggie Lake, who hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake. Maggie, thanks.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Yesterday, Richard Collins III was scheduled to graduate from Bowie State University, an historically black school. Instead, his chair sat empty. Early Saturday morning, around 3 a.m., the 23-year-old was stabbed to death at a bus stop after visiting friends at the University of Maryland, College Park. And 2 days before that, he'd been commissioned as a U.S. Army lieutenant. His alleged attacker, 22-year-old Sean Christopher Ubanski, was arrested shortly after the incident, is being held without bond. Collins was black. Urbanski is white. The FBI is investigating whether Collins' death was a hate crime. Urbanski did belong to what sounds like a racist Facebook group, but the founders say no, it was all a joke. Patrick Madden, a senior reporter with WAMU, part of the Here and Now Contributors Network. Patrick, some people were stunned to see this. There was even a question of a hate crime, but police say they have to do an investigation first. So what do we know about what happened at that bus stop? Witnesses said Urbanski told Collins and his friends to move over?
Right. I mean, the details are still very sort of spare at this moment. It sounds like there was a very brief altercation where Urbanski told or asked Collins to move. That didn't happen, and that's when the stabbing allegedly occurred. But I think the key thing here is that police are calling this an unprovoked attack, that these two individuals did not know each other, that there really was no reason for this to happen, which is why the attention and the focus of the investigation has been on whether, you know, Urbanski's alleged involvement in this Facebook group, the alt-Reich Nation.
Yeah, well, we're going to talk in a second about who Richard Collins was. But talk about that Facebook page. And by the way, Urbanski's been charged with first and second degree murder. But he has links to this Facebook page, alt-Reich, R-E-I-C-H. The site's been taken down. But the administrator of the site said it's satire, and people there didn't believe in the you know, anything like white supremacy. They were just trying to satirize it.
Right. I mean, that's the sort of conflict right now, which is these administrators of the site told the New York Times that this was all a satire. But the fact is, you know, the site was taken down shortly after this incident all happened. And according to the College Park police chief, David Mitchell, who did see the site, looked at the images, he said, you know, they were, in his words, despicable. These were racist memes targeting women, members of the Jewish faith, minorities, especially African Americans. So the content was clearly racist.
Well, again, Matthew Lamb, who was one of the founders, said he and his friends spent 2 days trying to come up with a funny name. But, oh, God, no, it's not white supremacist or a Nazi group, and I'm not a white supremacist. They were trying to play off the alt-right phrase that's used by the right by calling it alt-Reich. Well, what more do we know about Urbanski's involvement with the page? Or, you know, what are people saying about finding out that he is the one accused of this stabbing.
Right. So, I mean, and that's the thing at this point, and which is why prosecutors have come out and said it's really early in this investigation when it comes to whether or not this was a hate crime, because proving hate crimes are very difficult. I spoke with some prosecutors yesterday. You have to prove intent. You have to prove that that's the reason why this crime occurred, in this case, because of, you know, racism. So it's really early on in the investigation. They still have to sort of formally investigate this murder, and then they have to look at all of these questions about whether it was a hate crime. And that's why the FBI has been brought in to help with that investigation into this online group to see whether or not, to see what it is exactly and what Urbanski's involvement was and what role, if it did play, you know, in what happened Saturday morning.
People are saying that he wasn't very active on the page when it was up, and there's, you know, the investigation is going to include, is it, you know, a hate page? But meanwhile, Urbanski appeared in court on Monday. His lawyer told the judge alcohol and substance abuse may have played a significant role in all of this. There have been reported hate crimes on other campuses in the area. American University in D.C. had incidents of bananas hanging from nooses on the campus. What's the mood at College Park and Bowie?
Well, I spoke with a number of black students from the University of Maryland yesterday, and they have said there has been a climate of racism on campus for a while now. They actually started a coalition of student groups called Protect UMD last year to sort of raise awareness for these issues. Mm-hmm. And there have been a number of sort of hate bias incidents on campus.
Yeah.
When I went through the logs, there were 25 incidents since 2015. So there clearly has been a lot of different incidents, you know, from posters to racist slurs.
Well, Patrick Madden, senior reporter with WAMU, will follow that. Thank you.
Thanks, Robin.
Master Sergeant Valenti Ortiz is a senior military instructor at Bowie State University. He knew Lieutenant Collins. Lieutenant Collins was in the Reserve Officers Training Corps there. Sergeant Ortiz, thank you for coming on under terrible circumstances.
Yes, no problem.
Yeah. Well, we know the graduation took place yesterday. How was his absence noted?
At the opening of the ceremony, we first posted the colors. We also wore a yellow ribbon embroidered with American flag colors too, in remembrance of him. And also during the beginning of the ceremony, the president also presented the hat and gown to the family at the beginning of the ceremony.
Oh, heartbreaking. We know a chair was also draped in black, an empty chair honoring Lieutenant Collins, and as you said, his degree and hat and gown accepted by his family. What did we lose here?
A great individual that was on his way to becoming a very successful Army officer. Fourth generation legacy of serving into the military.
Yeah. And we hear very competitive, won a certificate for scoring the highest points on his physical training. And don't get near a ping pong table, I understand, if he was in the room.
Yes, yeah, he had some interesting extracurricular activities that kept him busy, which were all on the positive side. And he was a great scholar. He did great in his academics. He was an athlete, as you stated. Any given day, he can show up here and ace an Army physical fitness test. And he was definitely also a leader. I mean, he served in various events for us. We have a Ranger Challenge team that we compete annually from the university. We have a Color Guard team. And also, he continued to volunteer at various events and football games to support the university also.
Yeah. I mean, he just sounds like a terrific young man. What were his plans after graduation?
After graduation, he really looked forward to living the legacy of his family. Like I said, he was a fourth generation soldier commissioning into the Army on active duty. And he did branch military intelligence, and he was looking forward to his ongoing training and starting his career.
Yeah. Look, I'm sure this has occurred to you. There's some irony here that this is someone who is committed to going into the military, putting his life at risk in danger zones around the world, and he's killed at a bus stop.
It is tragic and is unfortunate. It's a deep-hearted loss to his family, his friends, his ROTC comrades. And we are kind of all going through it right now, and it's very tragic. And we all knew that he was aspiring to become a great officer, and he had everything laid out ahead of time. And he was on the right path to continue to live his dream.
Well, it's a terrible loss to the country as well. Look, just before we let you go, the investigation is considering whether or not this was a hate crime. How are you and other faculty and students reacting to that possibility?
You know, I've known him for 3 years, and I've watched him come through the heartaches and, you know, the internal motivators that drove him to get where he's got to be. And I don't want anything to overshadow the individual.
Yeah. Yeah. But if it is a hate crime, just what would you want to say to the hater?
I really wouldn't have any words in the event that it did come, but I would rather, as he wanted everyone, is to, you know, be there for him, be happy, and everyone just to get along. I really wouldn't focus on anything negative.
Right.
I would live the legacy and help others follow the footsteps that he wanted them to.
Master Sergeant Valente Ortiz, senior military instructor at Bowie State University, commenting on Richard Collins III, who was on the path to be an officer and was stabbed to death at a bus stop. Master Sergeant Ortiz, again, thank you for your time and so sorry for your loss.
Yes, ma'am.
Air pollution may be disrupting your sleep, according to a new study by researchers at the University of Washington. Pollution can cause a number of health problems, including respiratory infection, heart disease, and stroke. And air quality is getting worse in many cities around the world. Joining us now is Christine Wiedenmeyer, who is a scientist at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first of all, what is in most urban air pollution? What chemicals and compounds are in it?
Well, one thing to know is that air pollution isn't just one thing. It is a combination of different gases and particles. And so when we think of urban pollution, we might be thinking about particles of different sizes. The smaller ones can be inhaled deeper in our lungs. And then you also have reactive gases like carbon monoxide or nitrogen oxides that come from our cars, and organic compounds that come from all sorts of things, from industries to pumping up our gas tanks at the gas station.
Well, this is a particular problem in major urban areas, including Beijing, Delhi, Mexico City. Where are we seeing the worst air pollution right now?
Actually, I think you just mentioned some of the big ones. The major metropolitan areas across Asia, China, and India have very poor air quality. We've seen terrible air quality in, for example, Singapore, when they have large-scale biomass burning or wildfires going in Indonesia and Borneo. We have terrible air quality in cities across Africa. So areas that have large populations and a lot of different pollution sources.
What about here in the United States?
Our air quality has actually improved dramatically in the last 20 or 30 years, thanks to regulations mandated by the Clean Air Act. But I would say some of our worst places might be Houston or Los Angeles still, but it really depends on the time of year and where you are.
Well, one of the things about Los Angeles and also Mexico City is that they have mountains that make the problem worse, right? How much of this is about the geography of a place?
A lot. As you might know, in Mexico City, it's surrounded by mountains. So what happens is all those pollutants get kind of trapped in by those mountains. And so they build up and the concentrations just get higher. And that, of course, is the case in LA when you have the right conditions. We even have that happen here in Denver. So topography plays a really big role.
And when you say that the Clean Air Act was responsible for helping to reduce air pollution in some U.S. cities, what specifically was done?
So what happened when levels of certain air pollutants go above critical thresholds that are unhealthy for people, then areas are required to come up with solutions, effective solutions for reducing that air pollution. And so it really depends on where you are in the country and what that air pollution is, but everything from putting catalytic converters on cars to reducing emissions from pumping gas. In the mountain towns here in Colorado, they even stopped wood burning during the winter to prevent all those particles from the biomass burning and from the residential burning. So it really depends. There might be putting controls on your power plants or other industry controls to prevent the pollutant emissions.
Do you expect that with some of the changes that have been proposed by the Trump administration involving power plant emissions, involving trying to restart the coal industry in this country, involving auto emission standards, are those going to reverse some of the gains that have been made in air pollution in this country?
I don't see that having a positive impact on our air pollution problems if we take a step backwards, causing more emissions, using less clean fuels, having less efficient fuel standards for our cars.
Are the causes of pollution different in the U.S. than they are in other countries?
Most definitely. We have different pollutant sources depending on where you are in the world. For example, in places like India, a lot of people cook over open fires and burn biomass for their cooking and heating purposes, which emit a significant amount of particles and other reactive gases to the atmosphere and contribute quite substantially to air quality problems. Another big issue that I see when I travel around the world is the burning of waste. A lot of places do not have waste management systems in place, and so a lot of municipal waste gets actually burned out in the open in uncontrolled ways.
When we were recently doing the show from Mexico City, we noticed the bad air quality in the city. But then I went online mm-hmm. to look at what exactly the problem was or how bad it was on that particular day and noticed that it was much worse in some of the more remote areas of Mexico, farther away from the city, I assumed because that's probably where a lot of the factories are.
That's right. It really depends where those pollution sources are. And again, the meteorology, you might have pollution emitted in one place, but actually it gets sent and transported on the winds somewhere else where it might be able to build up elsewhere.
That's Christine Wiedenmeyer, who's a scientist at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.